The Insight Podcast. Đây là nơi những câu chuyện về văn hóa và xã hội được kể bởi những vị khách khác nhau. Mình là Linh và mình chúc các bạn có những giây phút lắng nghe thật vui vẻ.
Welcome to the Insight Podcast. This is Ling, and today we have Sylvia Freeman. Hi, Sylvia.
Hi, Ling. It's such a pleasure to be here. I'm really excited to speak with you. My husband and I, we love working with young people. And we believe that young people, and that's anyone under 30 and under, because we're older than that, we believe in the power of youth to change the world. And that's why I love what you're doing. And you are reaching out globally and talking with, you know, so many interesting people. And this is your own initiative, Lynn. So that's why I was drawn to your podcast. And you were one of the first, actually the second person that I reached out to. I think I reached out to you and your friend at around the same time. And I love your initiative. Like, you just took the bull by the horns and you're like, boom, boom, boom. And you sent me this well-organized Google spreadsheet of the interview question. I was so impressed. We were so impressed with how really smart you are, how talented you are. So I'm really excited and looking forward to speaking to you. And my heart is also for Southeast Asia and the Asia region. So it's exciting what you're doing.
Oh my God, you just melt my heart. I have never heard such a compliment before.
Really? Oh, you know what? See, that's what my husband and I mean, especially my husband, Matt Friedman, he's so good at affirming people, especially young people and especially young women. And Matt has fought, I mean, longer than I have, he's fought for the rights of girls and women using his white middle-age male privilege. And you know what
yes.
I'm talking about.
Yes.
He uses his influence, his white male capital, to help lift up and empower women. So that's why, you know, my husband is very special. And all of our past work, all of our campaign work, you know, my research and my book on and campaign work on military sex slave survivors and victims of the Japanese military before and during World War II, and also all my work exposing and telling the world about modern day sex slaves, and his work too with companies, banks. We were putting under the Be the Hero campaign umbrella so that we can mobilize and empower everybody. And how can we empower everybody? It's by including every issue. So before, we were focused on fighting and eliminating modern slavery, especially sex trafficking and sex slavery. But we see that we have to branch out and include combating climate change and being the environment, right, and stopping bullying, stopping, making sure there's affordable housing for all. That's an issue that's very dear to my heart, because if you don't have an adequate roof over your head, how can you sustain your family? How can children study and succeed and prosper in school when they live in like a cage home or like a tiny, tiny flat, subdivided flat? And so we've branched out over the last several years. We've branched out to include every issue because we want to step up and take action, even if it's just one thing. And that one thing for some of my busy corporate friends, that one thing is giving money.
Because yes. That's all. Yes.
To do, because some of them have small children. And but you know, we want to challenge people through the Be the Hero campaign. We want to challenge them, take it one step further. Use your privilege to help those who don't have power, who don't have influence, who don't have choices. So that's really the theme of my memoirs and Matt's memoirs that are coming out this fall through Penguin Random House.
And, wow.
And that, yeah, we're really honored to be Penguin Random House authors. It's a real honor. And so that's why I felt I got to start promoting our memoirs. And that's why I reached out to you. And we're also just starting to do more interviews and really beginning to take off with our campaign work again. Because I told you before we started recording that over the last 2.5 years, I've been kind of in a sabbatical rest mode, wrapping up my memoirs that it's taken about 2.5 years to finish. The book is titled A Long Road to Justice, Stories from the Front Lines in Asia. And I detail the good, the bad, and the ugly. All my lessons, all my mistakes, my failures. And I will pass these golden nuggets on to the next generation, to you and your generation and younger, not repeat my mistakes, but be able to really soar and go beyond what my generation and Matt, what we've done, that our ceiling, the top that we've reached, would be your floor. So that's really our heartbeat. Spread the word, help spread the word about social change. You know, anyone can be a change maker. Anyone can be a hero, can be the change. And if you have millions of acts of change and kindness and love, that can change the world. That's one of the main themes of Matt's Be the Hero, Be the Change book that's being used by corporations like well-known banks, leading banks and companies and schools. So we're just trying to get that into the school systems as well, because I really believe in the message.
Yes, it's interesting that I just talked to Matt, and you are absolutely right. When I spoke to him, when we talk about the white privilege, and our rights to do something, it's interesting because when we mention white privilege, it's so funny when we just see the color of privilege. I mean, we all have at least something that we can do, right? And we can use them. And you've spent so much time to create your memoir from your mistakes, your failure, your journey. It's such an incredible time. And I'm so glad when you get to do it with all of your passion and all of your time. It's actually quite a contribution for yourself, isn't it?
Yes. No, I just feel really grateful that I had the time to really think about my life. And I believe every single person should be able to go through like a similar kind of process to take stock of your life and to think about what is my life's purpose? You know, in order to reach your full potential, I really believe that we need to know the lessons and to know what drives us. We need to learn from difficult situations. And that's what I want to encourage other young people. How can you reach your fullest potential? It's by being intentional. It's by knowing your identity, you know, knowing who you are, and not letting anyone or anything deter you from your mission and your goal in life. So I really believe that my mission and my vision for my life is that I want to use my communication skills, you know, my filmmaking, my book writing, writing articles and speaking. I want to use that to mobilize people to do acts of love and social change. So I really believe that in this next decade and in the coming years, I really believe that Asian women are going to rise. And I've been saying that for the last 5 years. And I see more, you know, especially in mainland China, I see the women just rising. So I'm excited about that. I do believe it's our turn. It's the next 50 years will be, I think, where Asian women will leave a mark. And partly because, you know, 100 years ago, if I had been born then, my feet would have been bound, right? They would have been like, you know, little
yes.
seen like the slippers. And it's scary. It's like, my goodness, this is just 100 years ago. And even when I think of my ancestors, like, you know, my grandma, she was really smart. My paternal grandma was whip smart. And she was the one in the village who everyone would go to read letters in Korean and in Japanese, because I'm
wow.
And she would write the letters for them as well. And I don't believe she had a high school education. She was just, I think she studied on her own. Yeah, in her era, women at that time were not encouraged to go to school for long.
Yes, she is one heck of a grandma, I'm telling you.
Yeah.
I'm curious. You just told me a story, which I'm curious about your background. Which your ancestors are Japanese?
So I was born in Korea, and then my family immigrated to Canada when I was 2 years old. So that was the start of a lot of, you know, identity issues, because I grew up in a mostly Caucasian school, in elementary school and in parts in junior high and or high school rather. So I was often the only Asian girl in class. All of my friends were mostly blonde haired, blue eyes. And I remember feeling like, oh, I'm different, you know? And when I go home, I speak Korean. And so I had two worlds. I would have to switch back and forth. But only later, you know, when I'm in my late 20s, 30s, did I realize, that's a gift to have two cultures.
It's yes.
amazing skill, isn't it? That we
absolutely
speak a different language. Although, actually, I forgot to share this part, but when I was 12, I said to my parents, please don't call me by my Korean name, Sejong, and my English name is Sylvia. But I said, don't use my Korean name, Sejong. Don't call me Sejong anymore. Speak to me only in English. I want to speak perfect English. And then I rejected my Korean heritage. And I began to think that being a Western person was better than being Korean. And of course, I've changed. I accept my Korean identity. I love being Korean and Asian. But back then, I used to joke, you know, I'm a white person trapped in a Korean body. In part, why this was like that is because I had experienced racism. Racism, because when some friends came over to my house and they saw the jars of kimchi, they were wondering, oh my God, did something die in there? You know, and it smelled and, you know, and I remember having a little dried piece of rice on my shirt. And one Caucasian classmate was like, hey, what's that? That's a bug. And I remember looking and I knew it was a dry as a rice, so I went, you know. And so it was those early experiences that really shaped me. And I'm thankful for it now, because that experience of being hurt and being rejected from my cultural identity and feeling shame and pain, it opened my heart and my eyes to human rights. And I'd say the seeds of standing up for what's right, the seeds for standing up for righteousness and justice, it started in those early experiences of racial discrimination.
Yes, you go for it. I'm inspired. That's a TED Talk right there.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, oh, man, there's more about being rejected for being a girl. I mean, I don't know. Were you rejected for being a girl? But like most Asian families,
who have we've been there. Right? We've been there.
I know. Yeah, exactly.
Depart. You had kimchi, and you felt like a banana. You know, like. Yeah, yellow on totally. The outside, white in the inside, you know?
Totally. I didn't want to marry a Korean guy. I mean, I, you know my husband, he's Caucasian. And so anyway, I've really come back full circle, and it's been healing for me to embrace my Korean side and to know that it's good to be Korean. I can feel comfortable in my own skin, because when I was living in Beijing for over 6 years, from 2004 to 2011, I remember just being asked, oh, if you're not Chinese and your Chinese is so bad, what are you? You know, people would often ask, and I'd say, well, I'm Korean Canadian, and they would say, oh, Korean Canadian. I thought you were Japanese. Oh, I hate the Japanese. And I would say, no, I'm not the Japanese. And yes, I know what you mean about the Japanese because of what they did with the comfort women, the military sex slaves or the Japanese military and the rape of Nanking. And we would get on that topic because that was something that I was researching through as I wrote my book on Japanese military sex slavery and the whole racism behind that and the need for racial healing reconciliation.
Mm. I saw two of your documentary films. One's about the phenomenon in Hong Kong, the slave grooms. And
oh, yes.
I loved it. God, like how I was so curious about your views. Did you have a vision before you made the films, or you just do it as your instinct told you?
Yeah, no, thank you for asking, and thank you for watching that film.
I loved it.
Everything I do. Yeah. Oh, thank you. My husband, Matt executive produced it.
And oh, so
everything I
yeah.
do. Yeah. Everything.
He was in there.
Yeah. He was in there. And everything I do, we are a team. And we really work amazingly well, you know, for a married couple, we work really well as a team. And with the slave grooms of South Asian men from Pakistan, India, Nepal, from the poor areas of those countries, these men were being deceived, and they thought that they were being married into a good family and that they would have money to send back to their families. So it was like a flip, a reverse of slave brides, because often it's women who are trafficked, sold as brides, right? And we wanted to tell the world about this underreported slavery phenomenon, because a lot of the attention goes and a lot of the money goes to women and girls in modern slavery and sex slavery. We just had so much compassion for these men, you know, who, because they're macho men, and South Asian men are very prideful because it's a patriarchal society. And the victims that I spoke with were suffering in silence for a long time, because when they would tell that, oh, my wife is beating me and her brother, my brother-in-law is beating me, and they're forcing me to work every day in the construction yard or construction workplace, dangerous. And he doesn't see one penny. The money goes into the wife's account or the brother-in-law's account, and his money finances the family, right? And he'll never see. And so this one victim whom I featured in the documentary and I wrote about in a newspaper article, he said that his wife, who was his slaver, hardly gave him any money. And so every day he would go to work. He couldn't escape because they knew his father, and there'd be a lot of shame in his family, and he didn't have money to go anywhere. He would be starving. And so I interviewed a few people who actually helped him and gave him food money. They affirmed his story and they said, yes, when, and that was important to get. Mm. Have witnesses say, confirm, this guy was starving. This Ashraf is his name, was starving, he beaten, he looked exploited, enslaved, he's a slave group. You know, they all affirmed it. And no man, no macho man from a patriarchal society would ever come forward and say, oh, I'm a slave group victim. I'm a slave husband victim. Who would actually say that, right? Psychologically speaking. So I knew his story was real. And the other interesting thing was, there were a few people in the Nepali community and in, I think it might have been Indian Canadians and other people who read the article, because the article it was a sensation in the South Asian community in Hong Kong and in other parts of the world. This Nepalese man from a community organization wrote in to SEMP and said, I don't believe that. That is not happening. And he was reacting because of the pride he has, because he felt that this victim's story reflected badly on his culture. And then some women weren't, South Asian women who were in the kind of a similar field of human rights, they weren't willing to go deeper to that, because I'm not entirely too sure, but I almost felt like they might be ashamed too, because who's the perpetrator? It's South Asian wife, it's a woman. It's the families who've been living in Hong Kong for generations. There were so many other details about that story and that were sad, and I even spoke to the wife. It taught me that men can be victims too. You know, slavery can happen to anyone. This guy had a university degree, but he didn't have many opportunities in Pakistan, where he was from a poor area. I mean, he was smart. Had he been born into a different family in a different country in the West, he would have had a different destiny.
Come to think about it, it's the consequences of how we used to victimize the individuals that we thought. When you interview, do you see there's a pattern? There's a slight chance maybe he was born in the West, he would have had another like change maker, right? Yeah. What kind of other scenario that which could have happened that is worse than being that?
Yeah. No, that's a fantastic question. And I often think, wow, you know, when I meet survivors of modern slavery and sex slavery, I often think, wow, you know, it could have been me had I been born in that family. And I think commonalities are the victims and survivors, or survivors, they are from impoverished families and families where they can't afford to send them to school or to support them beyond high school. And they're often in poor city or region where the opportunities are not plentiful. So by circumstances, they're limited. There are roadblocks. And they want to improve their life. They want a better life. So my husband has found through his research in Thailand that it's not the very, very poor are getting fate. It's those who are a little bit above those who are scraping by above the poverty line. And those who have a little bit of money and yearn for more and feel like it's just in our grasp to improve and go upward social mobility wise. So it's also girls who are in sex trafficking and sex slavery. They're often sexually abused by family members or teachers or people they're supposed to trust, or fatherless from divorced homes. There's a whole bunch of factors, but I think anyone can be deceived if there are circumstances, like all the star aligning.
So yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's heartbreaking, and that's why I feel motivated, you know, with the Be the Hero campaign. I feel very motivated and fired up that those of us who have the power to choose our life choices, and we can go from one job to another, and we have the money, we can choose what to do with our money. I really believe that it's us who can change, right? We don't have to have the white picket fence life. And that's a Western term of, you know, after university, you get a job, you buy a house, you have kids, you have cars, you have the comfortable life, right? And I'm saying, you know what? We also can not just have our own comfort and stay in our comfort zone. We can reach out and we can make a difference in small ways.
Yes, definitely. Some really good points on that as well. When I talked to Matt before, oh my God, he's so passionate about this campaign, and I am on halfway reading the books, and so far I am digging it. I'm loving it. It's
yeah.
There's so many stories. Yeah. There's a very strange thing that happened when I read the books about this campaign. These stories kept coming up to me and I kept imagining them. Aww. Yes, some of the story when I imagined would be a very not so nice situation.
Yes, exactly, exactly. That's the power of being able to be a voice for those who have no voice, the voiceless, the most marginalized people on earth. And that's what you're doing through your podcast. You know, you're doing your part to raise awareness by interviewing people like me who yearn and want to make a difference through our books, through our movies, through our films, through our speaking engagements and training. So that's what you're doing right now, even though you may not recognize it all the time, but it's more than the average person, Lynn. So got to congratulate yourself, you know, pat yourself on the back and inspire others to do the same.
You just did that to me. You just gave me one of the greatest thing that I've heard in today. But I think that's what we need, right? I mean, I think women, when we hear support from each other, we get this super amount of confidence that we don't know that we had before. And your work inspired me so much. I mean, being a filmmaker, there's a certain extent of filmmakings that interest you from the first place. Can you share it with us? What is it?
Sure. Well, I've made hundreds of documentaries over the years, you know, from radio documentaries to TV documentaries. I feel like I've done so many that I now want to do something a little bit more creative. And I want to bridge East Hollywood, Hollywood in Asia, with Hollywood in the West. And I want to produce movies that will tell about global stories like the Japanese military sex slavery, because that's an underreported, untold story in some countries. And I want to share the need for racial reconciliation and healing between the Japanese and her neighbors, like the Chinese, civilians. And why? Because the Japanese government has not given a healing apology that satisfies the survivors, the elderly survivors of Japanese military sex slavery. They've said perfunctory apologies, but it's not enough. They must go deeper. They must give an apology once and for all that will restore trust, build relationship, because I know a lot of Japanese friends who feel like, oh, we apologize all the time to our Chinese friends, our Korean friends. And so I hope that we can raise awareness, expose and bear witness to what the women and girls suffered. Many of them have died. They were murdered. right? And we need to tell the world, because this cycle is repeating, that the euphemistic comfort women, it's happening. There's modern day sex slavery that's eerily very similar in their technique, in recruitment, and how the girls suffer, you know, while they're in being enslaved and sexually exploited and enduring sexual violence. And also later, the traumatic impact, they still suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder, and they need healing. They need healing.
Yes, absolutely great. What is your view on today's women sex slavery? What kind of action could be considered as when you enslaved a woman? And sexual harass, there is a line there. How could you take notice on those things?
Sure. Okay, so sexual harassment is separate from sex slavery. Like, sex slavery is where you just have no control. And it is, from the interviews I've done with victims, it is probably the most unimaginable form of suffering for women. We can't even imagine it. Really different from the harassment that one could experience at work or in a bar. But I'm not diminishing the pain of it. It starts there. Sometimes it starts like that, and it could escalate, right, into threats. It could escalate into rape. So I would say to women, know your rights. Stand up for yourself. Don't be silent, because so many women, I mean, all women, I think our tendency is not to speak up, right? And that's yes. why the whole Me Too movement was so powerful, because all of a sudden, women who are being touched on the bum, or a man says, let's get together, you know, come to my hotel room. I mean, I've had a government official in Canada actually say that to me in a Christian conference. He actually said, come to my hotel room. And
oh my God.
Like, oh my goodness.
That's terrible.
Kidding me? I couldn't believe it. Couldn't believe it. And if I told you who, you would be shocked. Okay. And of course I have boundaries and I'm strong, but what if it was like a weaker woman who, you know, who is more vulnerable? But the issue separately, the issue of sex trafficking and sexual exploitation of girls and women, there are 4.5 to 4.8 million girls and women suffering and languishing in sex trafficking and slavery around the world. Most of them, I would say, are in Asia, and because of the large populations in India and China, countries like Japan are like a real trafficking hub. It's like a cycle that's being repeated of Japanese military sex slavery, the comfort women system, that euphemism, comfort women, came out of the Japanese military, because the women that they recruited from across Asia, and also Dutch women, mostly teenagers, 400,000 of them, they forced into rape camps called comfort stations, you know, wherever the war zones were. And in China alone, there were over 1,000 rape stations, only in China. Yeah. Cool. And where victims, I've read in a UN report where the victims would be in these little stalls, like cattle, right? The lineup of soldiers would be long. Like, so some of these victims were raped by up to 50, 60 men a day. And they were teenagers, like around my age, like when I first found out about it in the early 90s. They were, you know, 15, 16 years old. And I was 15, 16 years old when I first learned about it. And that's what struck me. I thought, this is a Korean survivor who came out in 1991, Kim Hak-soon. And she spoke publicly and in the media because the Japanese military accused her of being a voluntary prostitute. And she was like, no way. So she was the first Me Too movement to speak out, the Me Too woman to speak out. She was the first, and it happened in Asia. So she went against the grain of the stereotype that of Asian women being silent and submissive and not being willing to speak out. It's an interesting connection that you made. There are forms of abuse in the workplace too. Mm. There are forms of slavery as well, right? Like you can have interns who work for free for like 60 hours a week, you know, and it's happening everywhere, and it pervades the food we eat, like the fish, the shrimp. We have to know, where is the source? How did they get it? Are you using slaves to make this, to make money off of cheap labor? And so we can be responsible buyers and consumers. That's what we can do. And for what we can do to take action for women and girls in sex slavery. And I wrote about that in my book, and Matt has written about that in his book that will come out in the fall. We recommend just step out, do something, give, donate, or volunteer your time at an organization that is helping. It doesn't have to be big. It could be you help with social media for 6 months or 3 months, or you find an organization that you really believe in and you support them. You know, all of these little things add up. Or you post a video on your social media, on your Twitter, your Instagram, your Facebook, and you just tell your network, your friends, this is what's going on, and I want to tell you about it. This is an issue that's important. There are people who are suffering out there. We've been blessed to have professional jobs. You know, we can do something about it. So that's our message. Also with young people, I really believe young people have more time, they have more energy, passion. And in history, all of the major upheavals and revolutions, it's been started by young people.
I think the young, when they make the contribution, they follow the steps of the frontliners, of the older generation, of the people who have come before them, and they took lesson from it, and they learned from it, and they learned fast. It proves that the recent labor rate percentage are mostly young people, because they are active, they are quick with technology, and very creative. I forgot to say, you know, when you imagine the generation, the Gen Z, which is very, very new, which the people were born from the 2000s, right? Yeah. And you imagine, that's... Yes!
Yes, the millennials, yeah. you're a millennial, right?
Yeah, let's say there's a thing that you just said which stunned me, is that the Me Too movement and the voice of the woman who brave enough to come forward and expose all the wrongdoings. Those percentage that you've given out, which mostly come from Asia, which cause do you think is actually made? Why that percentage are so high in Asia countries and not Western countries?
With China and India's large population, you know, that there could be more slavery incidences. Statistics really hard to come by in those countries, because they don't want to reveal, right, what's going on in their country to the world. And it's also very difficult to count the number of women in sex slavery, because there are women hidden away in massage parlors. And I'd say the incidences of sex trafficking is just as high in Canada and America. I mean, it's rampant. It's rampant over there. And in America, they had something called Craigslist or Backpage. It was on an online website where they were showing photos of underage girls, you know, and selling them online. And so there was a famous article that talked about how there were credit card companies that were enabling customers to buy underage girls. And so there was an outcry in the US and all over the world about it. So, you know why this happens? It's because of greed. It's because of greed. There are people, even women, who want to sell other women. And they're motivated because they may not have other ways of making money. And then there are criminal gangs who are involved. There are mom and pop opportunists who are not part of a gang, but just want to make a quick buck. You know, so it's human nature, it's greed. You know, people, when they want to or can take advantage over of a person to get something, to gain something, they will. They don't have a moral compass. And I hope that answers your question, but it's global, and it's, I can't say that one culture is more vulnerable to it. It happens everywhere, but there have to be big populations like India and China are some of the biggest countries in the world.
Well, let's talk more about your journalist journey. You have an astonishing 10 years of interviewing and research of survivors, academics, lawyers, and activists in different nations, which is incredible. So which story do you think that has made the most impacts on you and your life personal?
Oh, so the 10 years of researching the Japanese military sex slave survivors and academics and activists, that was just for Japanese military sex slave, or euphemistically known as the comfort woman. I've spent more years on interviewing victims of, you know, other modern forms of slavery. And the reason why it took me that long was it's really hard to get materials in English, even interviews in English, back in those early days in the early 2000s. So my vision was, you know, I learned about this issue when I was 15, turning 16, and I couldn't find a single reference to Japanese military sex slave survivors, victims, Asian victims. I couldn't find it in my European-centric textbooks, history textbooks in Vancouver, Canada. My vision was, I want to write something that can be in English and is easy to read. And I want to interview as many survivors as I can in person, but it's hard to arrange because everyone, all the victims are in Asia and I was living in Canada. So there's so many survivors who touched me, but the one who got me first, you know, on the journey, you know, got the ball rolling was Kim Soon-duk. She was the first survivor of Japanese military sex slavery. She was around 83 years old when I met her in Washington, D.C. I only had very short time with her because she had to take a train to New York. And I flew into D.C. in a matter of 3 hours. I made a decision, got in my car, drove from Victoria, B.C. in Canada all the way to Seattle, the airport, parked my car. I didn't even have a hotel room, and I flew in because I felt, wow, this woman is like a Holocaust survivor, right? Mm-hmm. The weightiness of her story. And then she told me about how she was deceived, promised a job as a nurse, but she was forced into sex slavery for Japanese soldiers for many years. And then she was, after the war ended, she was able to go home, and she held on to this secret for over 50 years. She had a partner. She didn't get married because she felt too dirty and ashamed to get married because she was a sex slave all those years ago.
And, oh my God.
Yeah, and then she said, tell the world. And that's what set me on a path of, I'm going to use my holiday time, I'm going to use my own money to record these stories. And I've translated this book to Japanese, but I have not found a Japanese publisher yet. I hope to find one soon. And my Chinese book is in process too. I'm waiting for that to be published. I don't know when, but I'm hoping it will be published soon as well. Yeah.
You get a big hope for that book. I believe it's going to be great.
I hope so for those women. And it took me so long to gather the material. So, or most of them died before my book came out.
Oh my God. It's so sad to hear. Also, I know how hard you must have been working to gather all of those materials could be translated into languages easily to reach out. It must take a handful amount of work. You must be very proud of it.
Yeah, well, I feel like the least I can do, it cost women everything. It destroyed their lives. And I am a writer and a doctor. I love history. It was my privilege to be able to use the little the little contribution that I can give to document this important history and to hopefully mobilize people to be agents of change and agents of love and compassion.
Mm. Do you think this is also because of the heritage that you have as a young person and also of your background that you decided to get involved into directed so many humanitarian portfolios?
Mm. Well, I stumbled into that job as a philanthropy advisor in 2005, and I loved it. And I realized I'm a financial activist. I love being like Robin Hood, taking from the rich and giving to the poor. If it will help slavery victims, if it will help the poor and the marginalized, I wish I can do more. I've directed over $9 million. It's gone to anti-trafficking program, to helping victims recover, to HIV/AIDS programs, to North Korea aid, and to migrants, children's education. I mean, I really believe in that. I love giving that money away on behalf of the wealthy.
Mm. During those times when you working with organization to help to prevent human trafficking and women's slavery, who is your target audience of your movements and all this campaign?
Just anyone, professionals, young people. We hope that we can inspire and motivate people to reach their own full potential too as human beings. Because if you reach your full potential, then think about beyond your territory or your family, and you can reach out to other people and help those in need.
Yes, definitely. As soon as I saw you and Matt's profiles, do you think that all those years of giving presentations, of raising funds, that comment is the magnet that leads you together?
Oh, definitely. We have a common vision, and yeah, just of being able to use our time, experiences, and our contacts and resources to help connect others, to motivate and inspire other people. So that's definitely what drew me to Matt. And then we got married, and we work well as a team.
Yeah. Mm. It's so lucky to have your partners as your partners in crime, right?
Yeah.
So lovely.
I highly recommend it.
Yeah. I would highly recommend that too. So one last question. You are currently be writing and producing and be doing your memoir. Could you share with us a little sneak peek about the work that you are still doing in progress right now?
So are my memoirs, A Long Road to Justice, Stories from the Frontlines in Asia, it will be coming out this fall along with my husband's memoirs. His working title is Where Were You? A Profile of Modern Slavery. And we have been working on our books, on the copy edits the last year. So it is quite an intense, rigorous process. And but one thing that we've taken away from this process is, wow, you know, it really details our life's work. And we're honored that we have this once in a lifetime opportunity to crystallize, you know, the lessons and to write about the special people we've met, the survivors who have suffered so unspeakably, and be able to respond and take action. So we hope that my book and my husband's will help change and make it a better place.
Yes.
We need more hope in this post-pandemic world.
That's right. That's right. When you talk about changing, it's a very simple thing.
Absolutely. It's anyone can do it.
Yes. Everybody can be involved. And I am on my halfway reading the books. If there's one fact about me that I rarely read any books, let's just like get it. Let's just get that straightened down in a line. But I'm so digging this book so far. So far.
No, I'm glad you're enjoying the Be the Hero, Be the Change book by Matt. Thank you for reading that. Thank you so much for this time.
Thank you so much. I feel so grateful. I get to know two incredible person and their work. It's a crucial thing to get informative about such things. So they are definitely inspire us to make an action. So thank you, Sylvia, so much. You have been an incredible guest.
Thank you so much for inviting me. Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
All right. So I think that this is the end of the part two of Sylvia and Matt Fielman's journey into human trafficking journey and modern slavery. There's more onto of the topic that you can find out by yourself on the internet, on any resources that you can find. I will also put the link of Matt and Sylvia's works in the descriptions, as I did in the previous part. And also, I will let the links to Sylvia filmmaking's works that you can also get access into, and their books, the campaigns, just such amazing campaigns. I hope that you've been enjoying listening to this podcast so far, and thank you so much.
Thank you.
All right, we'll see you in the next episode.